Go ahead.
July 29, 2010, at the Federal Reserve, the 20th in Constitution in Washington, D.C. And if we could just, for the record, could you guys identify yourself?
Dave Caperton of the Federal Reserve.
Scott Alvarez at the Federal Reserve.
Bill Nelson at the Federal Reserve.
Bill English, Federal Reserve.
Kieran Fallon, Federal Reserve.
Bruce McWilliams, FCIC.
Chris Seifer, FCIC.
Tom Green, FCIC.
Art Wilmarth, FCIC.
Sarah Knauss, FCIC.
Thank you. As you guys know, we're from the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, established by a statute last year, telling us to figure out the cause of the financial crisis. As I've talked to, I think, both Scott and Dave on the phone before, we are currently looking at the issue of too big to fail. And we are also looking at that in the context of, amongst other things, both Lehman Brothers and Wachovia. And so, of course, we wanted to talk to folks at the Fed. Since we know about Section 13.3 of the Federal Reserve Act and know that it was not invoked for Lehman and was invoked for other institution-specific assistance and non-institution-specific assistance. And we also know that when the assisted bid from Citi was approved, that was approved under the systemic risk exception of FIDICIA. So we're interested in initially just sort of getting your guys' general take on, you know, how the Federal Reserve goes about identifying and monitoring institutions that are quote unquote considered systemically important, what the protocols are when, God forbid, they get in trouble, and then, you know, if you can tell us, you know, what the specific issues were with Lehman Brothers and why the 13.3 exception was not invoked, and if you can tell us about Wachovia, and then maybe just more general, we know 13.3 has been, you know, invoked for, as I said, both institution-specific assistance and non-institution-specific assistance. We'd love to hear your take on, you know, what the Fed's thinking is on that generally and for the specific programs that have been used. In 5 minutes or less.
5 minutes or less, we just did the best we could with what few tools we had. Let me start with the first question, and you know, you guys all chime in. How do we monitor institutions that are systemically important? I think it's easy to look backwards and say there should be somebody monitoring institutions that are systemically important. But as anybody who's a student of supervision and the statutes know, that's not how the law is set up. That isn't how folks walked into the crisis. It is certainly a way we readjusted ourselves during the crisis, but going into the crisis, there was a very compartmentalized system of who regulated what. There were requirements that folks defer to other people who were the experts, so we had to defer to the SEC and securities broker dealers. We had no authority over thrift holding companies. You know, there were whole swaths of the banking industry nobody was empowered to supervise at all. So it was not a system that was built around the concept of systemically important institutions or special attention being paid to those kinds of institutions. And interestingly, I think systemically important institutions, if you look at them and look at this crisis, were more than just banks. There were banks, securities firms, insurance firms, and other kinds of institutions. So there was no one grouping that explained them all. And so so we didn't approach the problem in quite that way. That said, as the crisis progressed and we began to understand how a big institution and that was really interconnected or had a special role in a particular market could affect that market. And as the economy was getting more sour and those vulnerabilities became more apparent, we began to use what authority we had to monitor situations. We talked to other agencies that had authority to monitor the situation, and they used their authorities, and there was more or less sharing of information depending on the situation. protocols for assistance, I think that's sort of a similar kind of thing. Going into the crisis, I think we didn't really have a playbook for large institutions failing like they did in the crisis. Going into the fall of 2007, I think the playbook we had was based on 9/11. You know, what do you do in a situation where there's some kind of terrorist attack or natural disaster or something disruptive happens outside the industry that has an effect that, you know, requires closing of markets, or, you know, how do you stabilize folks in that kind of situation? That's not really built on 13.3. That's more built on redundancy of operations. It's built on making sure we can talk to all the people that are important, and everybody important can talk to other people that are important. Everybody knows what everyone's role is. Again, we're working within the statutory framework we had, so we tried to build around that. 13.3 is a very interesting authority. It's a very limited authority in the sense that it only allows lending. And that's a normal thing for a central bank to do. But still, secured lending is secured lending. It's not buying equity. It's not doing any, you know, it's not resolving institutions. It doesn't give you power to put somebody into bankruptcy or to resolve them in any special way. It just allows you to make a loan on a secured basis with the expectation of being repaid. So the first opportunity that seemed to be a useful thing for us to do was when Bear Stearns was facing collapse. And that was a situation where we found out late Thursday night that they were going to have trouble opening the next morning. And there was the hope that if we lent to them, they had plenty of collateral for the size of loan they needed. So if we lent to them, they would make it to the weekend, and that would give us an opportunity to consider our options, see if there were any purchasers for Bear Stearns, and try to stave off market turmoil. As I mentioned, they had lots of collateral. They needed about one day's worth of operating funding, so it wasn't a particularly large sum as life goes. And we lent to them on a secured basis. They repaid us at the end of the day, and we moved into the weekend. And I contrast that to the situation with Lehman Brothers 6 months later. In Lehman Brothers, we worked very hard to try to find a partner for Lehman. And as you guys know, there were several candidates, and by the end of the weekend, there were no candidates. We also tried to assemble a private sector solution. We had all the large financial firms and securities firms at the New York Reserve Bank, the Secretary of the Treasury, the President of the New York Reserve Bank, the Chairman of the SEC. All were there, all talking to those institutions about putting together a private sector solution for Lehman Brothers. When there was no solution available, there really was very little we could do. One of the things we had learned from the Bear Stearns situation was, while we might be able to fund one day's worth of operations for a company that looked like it was just struggling, we could not do what a broker-dealer needed to remain open for an extended period of time, which was to stand prepared to guarantee all of its obligations. So it allowed Bear Stearns to open on Monday while it was working out the details of its deal with JPMC was a guarantee that JPMC gave publicly to all the obligations of Bear Stearns, and that kept the market willing to deal with them. Lehman Brothers had collateral, but Lehman Brothers didn't have collateral sufficient to be able to for us to do a guarantee of all its obligations. And so it did, in fact, borrow some, the broker-dealer, borrowed some from our PDCF on that Monday so that the broker-dealer could continue its operations through the week till it got to the bankruptcy sale to Barclays at the end of the week. But Lehman the parent and the rest of its organization just didn't have enough collateral. Without collateral, 13.3 isn't really much good. It's expected to be secured lending. It would have been, we think, not prudent for us to lend on an unsecured basis to Lehman. So we didn't lend, and Lehman went into bankruptcy. That was one of the reasons that we began calling pretty quickly for a new resolution authority, and that's something that we hope will be a much better solution next time around. Citigroup, this is several months after Lehman Brothers. Citi had its own crisis of confidence, which began with outflow of deposits in Asia, and some concern that if they didn't announce a way to support their RMBS and CMBS that the market at the time was finding very low in value, that Citi would itself collapse. So we worked with the Treasury, which by this time had TARP authority, and with the FDIC to construct the ring fencing arrangement. We did not actually have to lend anything under the arrangement. We were simply the last stop if Citi was not able to itself fund losses, had to get funding from TARP, and that wasn't sufficient, and then went to the FDIC, and that wasn't sufficient. So we were pretty far down the line. And indeed, a year later, Citi was able to buy its way out of the ring fencing arrangement, and we never extended any funds at all. But were we to extend funds at that point, we would have lent against a portfolio of designated assets that were in excess of that had a value in excess of the amount that we would have lent. And then in Wachovia, you mentioned that isn't really a 13.3 issue. That's a systemic risk determination that was made, I guess, before the Citi ring fence arrangement. And there, the FDIC stood ready to provide a loss sharing arrangement to Citigroup if Citigroup was the winning bidder for Wachovia. As you know, Wells Fargo put in a superior bid and took Wachovia without any assistance from the FDIC or from us. So the systemic risk determination turned out not to be necessary in the end. So that's like the Reader's Digest condensed version of all of this. We're happy to talk to you in more detail about it or go through parts that are more interesting.
Sure. So let's back up to the first part you talked about and how, you know, there's certain systemically risky institutions that the Fed doesn't have jurisdiction to oversee. But there's some you do. So for the institutions you do have jurisdiction to supervise, is there something that the Fed did back then in terms of, hey, this bank holding company is big and systemically important, and so we supervise them in a different way than we do other banks, perhaps?
Sure. So the large banking organizations, all bank holding companies, we examine. And we examine, we spend less time on the shell companies and much more time on the ones that have some kind of operations. But a group like an organization like Citigroup or Bank America, JPMC, Wachovia, those holding companies, we examine on a regular basis. The largest ones, we have a continuous presence at the organization. So some number, depending on the size, could be a dozen, could be two or three folks on site all the time, talking to management about the risks they're taking, seeing their risk management reports, exploring different parts of the organization on a sort of sequential basis so that we, over a period of time, will see all the major operations and all the major areas of risk. And we have regular meetings with their board of directors to explain concerns that we have. We have regular meetings with the management of the organization to talk to them about weaknesses and ask them to address weaknesses. During the crisis, we stepped that up. We were spending not just more time, but we were being tougher on organizations and giving them less leeway to fix problems in the ordinary course and making them fix problems quicker. We pushed organizations to raise capital at any opportunity. We cut off dividends. So, you know, we were ratcheting up our supervision as the need arose for that.
Could I ask you a question? I know that these, at least I understand these resident teams were in a sense joint teams, that you had examiners, the OCC had examiners, and the FDIC might have an examiner attached to the team. There are different reports as to how seamless that joint operation was, to what extent you felt you got adequate cooperation from, let's say, the OCC, the primary regulator. I mean, from your perspective at Citi, at Wachovia, Bank of America, was there less than a seamless flow of information back and forth between you and your examiners and the OCC examiners?
So I would say a couple of things. First, I think we feel we have really good relations with the OCC in particular. And the ones where the institutions we're talking about are largely national banks.
Right.
Or state member banks, so it's us. So with the national banks, I think we feel we have a pretty good relationship with the OCC. And through the years, we've had our tussles, but we've gotten to where we share information pretty regularly. Some of it, of course, depends on the personalities of the people involved. Right. There's always that in every inter-human relationship. But I don't think we saw that there was anything material that was a problem in the relationship between the Fed and the OCC at the large institutions.
And just going one step further, you mentioned this. I mean, that you don't have direct authority over the broker. You did not have direct authority over the broker dealers. You had essentially backup authority. You had to ask the SEC for information or maybe ask for permission to go into the broker-dealer. Now, what about that relationship? I mean, obviously all these institutions had pretty large broker-dealer operations. How well was that relationship working between you and the SEC?
So that relationship is a little different for a couple of reasons. One is the SEC just isn't a prudential regulator and wasn't at the time. And Chris Cox was trying to turn the SEC into more of a prudential regulator, but that's a monstrous change both in culture and in the amount of resources that were needed, and they just didn't have the resources they needed to be a prudential regulator at the large broker-dealers. So to some degree, there was just not as much information available of the type we needed from the SEC.
Even, let's say, for the city, for Citigroup's operation?
Remember, it's a broker-dealer.
Right.
So they just weren't examining the broker-dealer in the way we would examine a broker-dealer for prudential strength. So the relationship between the SEC and the Fed and the SEC and the OCC is much newer, the sharing of information, too. So we don't have as smooth a relationship to start with. We're organized in very different ways. We have exam teams that are resident in no city. They have traveling teams that, stop in at the broker-dealer at Citi for 2 weeks, and then they're off at the broker-dealer at Goldman Sachs, and then they're off. They don't have experts in a particular organization. So that makes it a bit harder to get the kind of information that you want, and it makes it harder to have the liaisons that you would like, because they, by the time we need them to tell us about the Citigroup broker-dealer, they're off at another broker-dealer with another assignment, and so we're a low priority. So there's a lot of things that made it harder. There's also there was a concern for a long time that the SEC, while it had less information to give us, information we gave them would be used not for prudential purposes, but for strictly securities law enforcement purposes. And, I think we were concerned that our examiners' judgments, we thought somebody should be rated a 1, 2, or a 3 on the exam, that would affect how the SEC would look at the proxy statements for the bank holding company. It wouldn't really be used for prudential purposes, but for other purposes. And we haven't trained our examiners to speak and to think like they should if they're going to be talking about public disclosure we think of them and train them to talk about safety and soundness. So we were nervous about that. But the chairman and Chairman Cox worked through that problem, and by the early summer of 2008 had worked out a protocol for sharing information between the two agencies that I think largely dealt with that enforcement problem. So then it was really just a matter of what information do they have and what information do we have and can we share it and is it useful information.
Can I go back to what the question was just before, embellish a little bit on your question about the structure we use in supervising the larger institutions. In the fall of 2008, we issued sort of comprehensive supervisory guidance concerning the Federal Reserve's consolidated supervisory functions and responsibilities. And that guidance had been in the works for some time, and it divvies up the various portfolios of our organizations as we use them for supervisory purposes, so regional organizations, LCBOs, and large financial institutions, the largest. And it provides in a pretty good detail how we see and structure our supervisory regime in a broad sense for the various organizations. And for the larger organizations, I think one of the goals of the that enhanced guidance was to focus our energies and to focus examiners and supervisory to the extent we could within the existing limited safety and soundness authority that we had on the activities of those organizations that potentially pose the greatest risk to the financial system. So, for example, focused examiner resources and supervisory resources with respect to core clearing and settlement activities, kind of risk management for key business lines and things of that nature. And then on the exam, on the sharing piece with the OCC and the FDIC, both of those organizations have online access to our full database for supervisory information for all the organizations we supervise. So that's our exam reports.
So let me follow up on that a little bit. I mean, one of the things that I've seen in some of the documents for Wachovia and that I've just seen in public information, I'll review articles and otherwise on prevented failures going back to the 70s, 80s, and 90s, is when a systemic risk exception is invoked, whether it's 13.3 or FDCPA or whatever, what seems to be driving it from what I see is we can't let the unsecured creditors take a hit because it's going to cause disruption to the markets overall, it's going to cause disruptions to the bank, other banks, and to the general economy overall. Whether you're talking about continental Illinois, whether you're talking about Wachovia, whether you're talking about First Pennsylvania or whatever it was,
yep,
or Bank of New England, all of those banks, it's always that type of issue. And so I'm wondering, for the large institutions that you do have jurisdiction over, is there separate examination procedures or supervisory procedures where you say, we need to take a real close look at the unsecured creditors, and we need to take a look at the liabilities for these banks, know who they are, know what the terms are, because if they do get in trouble, that's the issue that always comes up that we have to deal with.
So I think that's a couple of things there. One is that you don't have control over who the unsecured creditors are, right? So that's in the marketplace, and it's not necessarily that we're worried about a particular unsecured creditor. Oh my goodness gracious, grandma owns some of this unsecured credit. Can't let it fail because she'll be out of money. That's not the way we think about it. It's really the market confidence in the institution, the ability to raise capital, the ability to continue to issue debt. These institutions survive on the debt that they issue, the short-term debt that they issue, and that so it's important to understand how much more than who to. But I think, you can't stop the failure of an institution by just focusing on that. You have to look at the risk the institution is taking more generally and address those risks more generally. And there are other things that cause somebody to be systemically important. So, for example, Citigroup is involved in some 400 payment systems across the world. I mean, if it failed and were unable to meet its obligations there, that would have lots of knock-on effects throughout the world. There are, there are all kinds of exposures. The AIG situation, there were derivatives exposures across huge swaths of institutions, again, across the world, not to mention the individuals who were relying on AIG meeting its obligations under the insurance contract. So, you know, you have to, clearly some of the literature focuses on unsecured creditors, and there's something to pay attention to. But I wouldn't say that was the only or even the most important thing, and certainly not universally the thing that folks worry about.
There's a panoply of customer relationships, and the question is often, are those easy to replace in that situation? So I think one thing that you should realize is it's not necessarily the case that this institution is systemically important. It's potentially one where you want to take very strong steps to provide support in a given situation, because in that situation, disorderly failure could have really bad consequences for financial markets, for other institutions, for the customers and clients of that firm, for the economy. Whereas in a different situation, you know, that firm maybe could fail, and it wouldn't be particularly disorderly, it would be manageable, it wouldn't be that big a problem. So I think one of the things that we were doing as we were thinking about the actions we were taking was very much trying to assess the whole situation in markets and institutions to try to figure out what was the appropriate policy response, rather than just trying to judge kind of independent of the environment. Is this institution a systemic institution? That wasn't quite the question that I think we were facing.
I think if I could follow up on that,
sure,
just one quick. I think this is one thing where the chairman's historical expertise really was helpful, because there are a lot of differences between the 1930s and the crisis we just went through. But one of the differences is that, you know, that was a severe recession with a failure of a collapse of the banking system, and that's one of the reasons it became more of a depression. And what we were experiencing starting in 2007 was the beginning of a severe recession and the faltering of the financial system. And there was a lot of concern that if the financial system collapsed at that time, given that economic environment, we would be plunged yet again into the kind of, you know, depression, deeper recession from the 30s. So, you know, it really is the economic context becomes really important to deciding what you do and whether you can, how you react to different firms doing different things. I mean, if you look at the recessions in the previous few years, you know, the last 30 years, there wasn't the same crisis in the financial system that accompanied those recessions. So that's one reason you didn't see the same kind of responses around these large institutions in those times.
I'd note that the options, the alternatives to having an institution funded by unsecured creditors are not particularly attractive from the perspective that you're asking this question either. If they're funded by secured creditors, then those assets are unavailable to pay back the unsecured creditors or to compensate the FDIC for any payments that the FDIC makes on insured deposits. And if they're funded by insured deposits, then the U.S. taxpayer is on the hook to compensate for any losses there as well. So there aren't, you know, it isn't an obviously preferable strategy to have the institution be funded less by unsecured creditors. And the noteworthy thing in the recent crisis, the one thing that I think many people were very surprised by, was the extent to which, in fact, unsecured funding was an unreliable
secured
funding was an unreliable way to, you know, were unreliable sources of funds.
Right. Yeah. The repos.
Can I just say, not only for the record, but for your benefit, that this is Rich Ashton from the legal department who's joined us.
Mr. Ashton,
I see you, Rich. How are you?
And good. I understand that my question wasn't is one thing preferable than the other. My question is, from the Fed as a prudential regulator with big bank holding companies and you know, having to deal with systemically important institutions, what do you do in terms of looking at essentially the liability side of the balance sheet, and particularly the short-term funding. And I probably shouldn't have said unsecured creditors. I probably should have said short-term funding, and talk about, because when you do see what's happened with other cases in the past, when you look at Wachovia, that seems to be, at least the memos that I've seen, you know, that's the focus of whether or not the FDICIA systemic risk exception is going to be invoked, or whether 13.3 is going to be invoked, is what's the repercussions, what's the domino effect of this company going down? And a lot of that domino effect is the creditors of the company, whether they're secured or unsecured. And of course, the unsecured creditors take the biggest hits. So at least that's what we see in, sure. In the memos, and that's why I ask, you know, it's sort of a general question, what do you guys do? And, you know, you can imagine I ask other bank regulators.
That's a good question. Yeah. We don't mean it's not a good question. I think part of the other side that we were fighting against was just what Bill said. You know, while we would have loved to have these institutions lengthen the maturities of their debt, during the financial crisis, exactly the opposite was happening. Maturities were shortening and shortening and shortening to the point where some were funding overnight on a regular basis. That's a very precarious place to be. And we can yell as much as we want, bring as many civil actions as you want. You know, if the market's not going to give you longer term debt, the market's not going to give you longer term debt. So I say that to indicate that it's not always possible to have the supervisory result that you want obtain. And so we try, we do the best we can, but we're dealing in the realities of the marketplace and what's possible.
And well, I certainly get that once you're in the crisis and the market gives you the choice that you have and you're there. But before you get to the crisis, I mean, another thing we've seen in the cases from before, and thank Art for this because he alerted me to this research, is it seems like for the most part, the institutions where government assistance has been provided, they all sort of seem to follow the same path, right? I mean, they follow a fairly highly leveraged growth strategy, get into risky assets, and they fund it with short-term volatile liabilities. You know that just from looking at public filings, frankly. I mean, maybe you need some more granularity. So I'm wondering if, you know, given that we've seen that from bank failures as early as 1974 and probably earlier than that, and banks that were frankly a lot smaller than the $100 billion and trillion dollar institutions we see in 07 and 08, is there any thinking within the Fed, you know, about, now look, we've got a track record here. We can tell these folks before there's a crisis, you know, you don't get into those risky assets, or if you do, you have a lot more capital and you fund it with long-term liabilities.
Right. So yeah, I'd like life to be that simple too. I think, you know, one of the things Bill mentioned is that one thing we didn't count on is that even secured lending would become problematic during the crisis. You know, that had not happened before, certainly in my 30 years doing supervision. You could always get funding if you had enough security. And so liquidity plans that these institutions had were very strongly built on secured borrowing. That just didn't turn out to be reliable. The other thing is, I think it's important as a structural matter for there to be some institutions that do maturity transformation. So, you know, turning short-term liabilities into longer-term assets, that's been traditionally what the banking industry does. So, you know, ideally you'd want to have everything match the assets and liabilities, but society and the economy just don't work that way. So someone is going to be vulnerable to pressures in difficult financial times when there's when they're doing maturity transformation. We just didn't expect it to take on, you know, have this added complication that you couldn't borrow even on a secured basis. I don't know if you guys have more you want to add to that.
That's right. I mean, we don't have a supervisor here, but I think if somebody from PSR were here, they would say they did focus on many of the things that you're talking about. And to the extent that they did not, it would be things like secured financing, which people didn't realize would run to anything like the extent that it did. Securitizations, I mean, one of the things that happened was that institutions got caught with assets that they'd intended to securitize. They were funding them short because they were only going to hold them for a short time. But then the securitization market stopped for reasons we can go into. But they ended up holding those assets, and they had funded them short. And so they had a funding issue, and that funding became hard to roll over. So I think that there were a variety of risks that perhaps were underappreciated, but broadly, I think supervisors were aware of a lot of risks and were presumably addressing them.
There's certain similarities between Wachovia and the city. I mean, I think obviously city is much larger scale, but there was a commonality of sort of CDO exposure, commonality of sort of highly leveraged transaction exposure. I think Wachovia had some off-balance sheet conduits. Obviously, Citigroup had a lot more of those. I mean, at what point did those begin to appear on your radar screen? Because I realize with CDOs and SIVs, you know, that kind of bridges between the bank and the broker-dealer. But were your examiners and field supervisors saying, gee, we're seeing, you know, this buildup of exposures to CDOs or this buildup of off-balance sheet exposures, and we're concerned about that? And you know, were you beginning to push on the management to say, well, how are you going to handle these exposures? I mean, there's a certain commonality, not and of course they both were heavily involved in securitization, you know, pretty high level securitization. When did that begin to kind of, you know, rise on your radar screen, do you think? I mean, and to what extent were the management responsive in trying to tell you, no, we think we have a handle on it?
Yeah, I think we need to get some of our supervisors here to help you with that one.
Right.
I think we were aware of the growth in securitization. That was something people talked about. The extent to which the supervisors were aware of off-balance sheet structures, I'm not sure.
It's also true that I'm just very conscious of the fact that there are an awful lot of small institutions that are failing as well right now. The economy weakens substantially. Banking is a very pro-cyclical industry.
So let me ask you another question that sort of comes at it from another way. We've seen in the literature that in terms of how the Fed approaches macroeconomic policy and otherwise, that I think Greenspan and Bernanke have been on record as saying, you know, we're not going to use policy to burst the bubble. You know, we'll watch it. But when it does burst, we'll use the tools that we have to try to stabilize markets and deal with the repercussions. I guess my first question is that consistent with what the Fed's policy at least was up until the crisis?
I think that's right. I think this standard view is expressed by Greenspan was bubbles or asset price misalignments, whatever you want to call them. Excesses in asset markets are very, very hard to judge in real time. It's difficult to know that asset prices are wrong. You have to judge that a whole lot of market participants have it wrong. And that's hard to do with great confidence. You then have to judge, second, that you can use monetary policy, say tighter monetary policy, to address that misalignment in asset markets and move asset prices back to where they should be in some sense, presumably. And third, that you can do that without adversely affecting your ultimate goals of stable prices and maximum employment. And that's a pretty high set of bars to get over. It's been difficult to be sufficiently confident to know you want to do something. And I think the view has often been that you'd have to raise rates a lot to discourage people from investing in what they see as a very profitable activity. And raising rates a lot doesn't just put pressure on that narrow activity. It hits the whole economy, and so it can cause a recession, cause broader problems, and that's not a desirable outcome. Monetary policy is a blunt tool to go after asset price bubble, so it's better to try to use supervisory tools to go after excessive risk-taking by a particular set of institutions in a particular market or whatever it is, to try to address that in a much more kind of tailored way than to use monetary policy. Now, in a speech that the chairman gave within the last year or so, I think he kind of ended the speech by saying, well, on the other hand, if you tried that, you tried using your supervisory tools and you didn't think you were getting anywhere, the very bad outcome, the crisis suggests cleaning up afterwards is sometimes pretty hard, and maybe you shouldn't rule out using monetary policy. But he still clearly thinks that's well down on the list of things he's wanted to try to do.
So that was actually, I think you answered what was going to be my next question, and that is that policy still the policy of the Fed? And I think what I'm hearing you say is yes, but we're looking at it a little closer, at least based on, I guess, Chairman Bernanke's recent speech.
And can I just add a couple things to what Bill said? So
is that accurate?
Okay.
The Fed was seeing it from the inside. The market was perceiving it as asymmetric, that the market was perceiving it as a floor here and more of an upside there.
I'm just not sure. There was an important phenomenon that in my view, contributed to the financial crisis in a very sort of key but deep way, which was the Great Moderation.
Right.
And I think that the Great Moderation really happened. It wasn't just a perception of what the central bank would do, but in fact, there really was a moderation in economic activity and in asset price movements, which I certainly thought, and I think many people thought, meant that risk was lower. So I don't think that it's because there was some false impression that the Federal Reserve would protect against declines in asset prices. But I do think that there probably is some reasonableness that monetary policy contributed to an environment of stability, and that environment of stability facilitated the growth of the shadow banking system and
risk-taking,
and risk-taking that in the end, when that situation changed, resulted in the financial crisis. And the other thing I would just note is that there were supervisory actions taken in response to the excessive easing of standards in subprime and in commercial real estate lending during the crisis. Now those actions weren't in the end sufficient, but there were responses taken
prior
to the crisis. So monetary policy was not used, but even in the past, supervisory tools were used to address what were perceived to be a widespread departure of an asset price or a term or risk-taking behavior from fundamental or prudent activity.
If we go back for a moment to the eve of Lehman, in other words, where you know Lehman's in deep trouble, you haven't been able to find a partner, you haven't been able to find a private sector solution. Can you give us sort of your thinking? You know, you have to decide whether to pull the plug on Lehman to tell them you're not going to get help. To what extent did you look out and say, if Lehman goes and defaults on these obligations, there are going to be repercussions? What did you see those repercussions as being, and did you have some concern that they couldn't be contained? Because, there is this question about authority. We can talk about 13.3 in a little bit, but there's also this question, before you think about what authority you have, you also have to think about, well, what are the potential downsides if we don't act? And what did you sort of see those downsides as being, you know, if you pulled the plug on Lehman?
So I think in
people,
what's that?
I wasn't involved, so
there you go.
Maybe depending on Scott.
Thanks, Bill.
Sorry, but
I think there were a couple of factors in Lehman that I would mention. One is that Lehman was, let's see how to say this. Bear Stearns when Bear Stearns fell, that was unexpected,
right.
Really unexpected. We didn't have any facilities out there. The industry, you know, they'd been picking at Bear Stearns. It was clearly the weak sister of the broker-dealers. But the Friday that it went into demise wasn't the Friday anybody expected Bear Stearns to fail. So, but once Bear Stearns did collapse and got sold off, the market was more attentive, and they were looking at Lehman as the next one to fail. But there was also more preparation. We had several facilities that we opened up, the PDCF and the TSLF. We had an arrangement, a better arrangement with the SEC. You know, the GSEs started to shake, and we stood ready to make a loan to the GSEs, and then they were put into conservatorship. So the market, I think, had signs that they should protect themselves from Lehman. And they also had, I think, an indication that if we were going to provide support, it was there. The PDCF was the support. That's what everybody was saying at Bear Stearns. We should have done the week before. You remember? I mean, there were articles saying if there had only been the PDCF, Bear Stearns would have made it through. Well, there was the PDCF. So I think from that, plus we had the Lehman weekend where we brought together all the big market participants and said, here it is. This is the last weekend for Lehman. You've got to come up with a solution. So this one was one where there was a lot more preparation, a lot more the market had an opportunity to shield itself. And I think we thought that the market was preparing itself better. And then when Lehman failed, it really did send reverberations throughout the market that were greater than I think we expected. And then, you know, AIG stumbled just 2 days later.
Right.
And so it began to feel more like a collapse of the system than it did just an isolated incident.
Did any of the participants in that...
And the money market mutual funds, you know, they started collapsing.
That was,
I mean, things were falling all around us at that point.
Did any of the money market participants, or the bank participants in that fateful weekend meeting tell you, well, we can't save Lehman, but we certainly don't think Lehman should go. I mean, we think
so
it would be a real...
So that whole weekend, what they heard from Hank Paulson
and
the Federal Reserve was, we're not doing this.
Right.
We're not saving Lehman. You guys have to take care of Lehman. I mean, Hank's written a book that's basically, we weren't going to save Lehman. So I think there was no mystery about it.
And how correct was that statement by Secretary Paulson? There are, I mean, just to give you a sense, I mean, in the trustees report, Mr. Berlucas's report, there's an indication that Chairman Bernanke, actually Secretary Paulson himself, and then President Geithner were prepared to extend some level of federal support to someone that would purchase Lehman. Was that correct?
So I think that's the difference between the public message and what was in folks' minds.
Okay.
I think that what Paulson was saying and Geithner was saying to the folks publicly and in the room was, we are not prepared to provide any assistance.
Oh, no assistance.
No assistance. On the other hand, I think what you hear from the chairman is, in the back of his mind, he wasn't at the Lehman weekend. He was here in Washington preparing for the FOMC. You know, what in the back of his mind, if somebody comes to me and says, Lehman's going to fail unless you give a 13-3 loan for a few billion dollars, and it's something that we could do within our authority and collateral, we would have had to think about that. Don't know if we would have done it, but we would have had to think seriously about it. So... But that offer never happened.
Yeah. Let me see if I can prompt you just a bit. We've got a document which was Federal Reserve Board of New York document, which is FRBNY to Examiner 003516, which is their game plan document.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm sure you've seen this, but at page 2 under the heading FRBNY Financial Commitment.
Right.
The first bullet is, quote, we should have in mind a maximum number of how much we are willing to finance before the meeting starts, but not divulge our willingness to do so to the consortium. Was there a number?
No. And I think you should keep in mind what this document is.
That's fine.
I mean, there's staff at my level and lower whose job it is to come up with as many alternatives as possible. That's mm-hmm. one of the things we did to prepare. As you know, you started off, what were you doing to deal with systemically important institutions in this crisis? Well, as we became more aware of the effect of systemic institutions, we started having these role-playing, game-planning kinds of groups and what they would do. There's a lot of alternatives we considered that we would never do, some illegal, some you know, that are just really wildly interesting but not practical, and then there's some that are possible. But the idea was you had to try to think through options, and we wanted to think as much as possible about alternatives. And that's what this was. This was not you know, approved by the board or by the you know, Secretary Geithner at the time, President Geithner. So it doesn't reflect anybody's decisions. It reflects staff musings. And there was, you know, I think Paulson and Geithner were saying what they thought was the right thing, which was to, in some sense, I think, try to offset the moral hazard of having helped Bear Stearns, to get the industry to really focus on the problem and let them know that they had responsibility for this one, and that this one was, in the estimation of Paulson and Geithner and the rest of the Fed, a bit out of reach for us. And it turned out it was out of reach for us. So
now, some of the public documents suggest that that Chairman Bernanke was actually in Washington in the event that a 13-3 meeting might have been required to support a Lehman bailout of some kind. Is that correct? Was that part of why he stayed in D.C.?
So under 13-3, as you know, we have to have a vote of five.
Just five. Right.
Five members. One of our members was in New York, Kevin Warsh. So no matter what, we would have had to have an intercity communication. So I think the chairman could have been in New York if that would have been useful. But this was 2 days before an important FOMC decision. And so I think it being here to prepare for FOMC and take care of the other things going on with the Fed was the most important thing in his mind at the time. And Kevin was very capable and able to deal with the issue from New York. And the chairman could be available by phone. So I think it was all of those things going in his mind.
Okay. Now, there was obviously a run-up, as you've suggested, to the Lehman weekend. I mean, there was the B of A situation, and there was also something I'd like to ask you a bit more about, which is Mr. Dudley suggests circa July of 08 that a Maiden Lane type approach to this might make some sense. I have his July email with a
It was another game
Geithner.
Planning. Thing.
Was there a decision point at which the idea that there wouldn't be a Maiden Lane approach a la Bear Stearns, was there, did somebody decide that? Did it just kind of not get further discussed? Because you do, the principals do go to a long-term capital management approach to their solution, and this seems to not have been on the table at all.
So remember, a Maiden Lane approach is, at least in that summer and fall, what that would have meant was an acquisition of Lehman. So somebody buys Lehman and we deal with some small portion of assets. Mm-hmm. There was in July there was no purchaser. In August, September there was no purchaser for Lehman. So it didn't meet the situation of, it didn't match a Bear Stearns situation at all. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, was there a decision? Not per se, it didn't rise to the level of a decision because we weren't we never had a purchaser step forward to make an acquisition of Lehman.
Okay, that's a fair point, but that raised, and that segues interestingly, I think, to Bank of America, which I'd like just a little more illumination on. There is a suggestion that B of A decided not to further pursue Lehman mostly because they couldn't get financial guarantees or the ring fencing of what they regarded as toxic assets. Is that what you
so
must
that's
have
not my impression. I think you'll need to talk to Bank America to get you know, theirs, but my impression of the events actually was that Bank America was always more interested and comfortable with Merrill Lynch than with Lehman. Lehman was a wholesale broker-dealer. Bank America is a retail bank. Merrill Lynch is a retail broker-dealer. So, you know, the fit is just much better, both culturally and business plan-wise, for Merrill Lynch. They were willing to bid on Lehman Brothers because it would have been a big jump for them into the securities business. But it, in some sense, it wasn't the business they understood really well. So the more they looked at it, the more uncertain they were that they could manage all the risk there. And so each time they would look at the risk they were taking, they saw more risk. And it just, their sense of risk got bigger and bigger as they looked at it. So they clearly went into the negotiations without any expectation of any kind of assistance. As they began to look at it, they became more uneasy. They started talking about assistance. The more they thought, they started talking about more and more assistance and different kinds of assistance. And that's when Merrill Lynch said, "We're available." And so they just dropped off of Lehman and went straight to Merrill Lynch. And you can, I think the fact that they were more interested in Merrill Lynch comes from, you can see from the fact that it took no time whatsoever for them to reach a deal. They did that in an afternoon and announced something immediately, where Lehman, they had been doing due diligence for a long period of time and still struggling along. So,
yeah. What, I mean, to the extent you recollect, what were the numbers that Bank of America was talking about? And did they, in fact, come to you with a 13-3 sort of proposal? Or, I mean,
no, my memory is that they came to us saying there's a hole at Lehman, and the size of the hole kept growing. Mm-hmm. That was different than saying they need the 13-3 loan. That could have been satisfied, for example, by the parallel effort to bring the private sector folks together to do a capital injection. So it was, you know, it was really more a hole. And that's the way I remember them describing it. I don't remember the numbers very well, so I'd hesitate to.
Okay. To the extent you recollect, I mean, there presumably was a calibration of what that hole must have looked like. Reflected presumably in the amount of money that was being asked of the private bankers over the Lehman weekend, which resulted, as I understand it, in roughly $30 billion in commitment. Was that the size of the hole as the experts perceived it?
No, I don't think they were calibrating the size. I wish they were calibrating the assistance by the size of the hole, but I think they were trying to figure out how much they were each willing to spare, how much they could each put into a pot to solve a problem and not damage themselves. So the whole, my memory is that the numbers were bigger than what the private sector was willing to put forward. The whole that Bank America perceived was bigger than the numbers the private sector was willing to put forward.
And was there a sense of how that remainder, whatever size it might have been, would have been filled?
No.
Okay. And then I'm curious, too, about the purpose of the Lehman weekend. I've seen two perspectives. One is the purpose potentially was to try and save Lehman Brothers, keep it as a separate standalone company. The other was to provide essentially short-term funding for a disciplined wind-down of Lehman Brothers. Do you have a perspective on what the purpose
of
it was?
I think the purpose was to solve an institution that was getting deeper into trouble. We didn't have a particular solution to the exclusion of others. If we could have worked out a solution that would have been a capital injection and a wind-down, fine. If it was an acquisition by somebody else or splitting up the organization among seven or eight different people, fine. We were open to all potential solutions. It was, I think, more driven by the fact that folks believed Lehman couldn't continue to operate at the level that it was at, that it had blown through its liquidity and its capital, and it needed some kind of solution. We were open to any kind of solution. Mm-hmm.
And in that general regard, I mean, I'd like you to confirm this for me. One suggestion of why the Lehman weekend, while the Lehman weekend did not fulfill whichever purpose it had, whether the thoughtful wind down or the saving of Lehman Brothers, was this guarantee problem vis-a-vis Barclays, which of course then implicated the FSA. The first prefatory question is, what was the size of that problem in terms of dollars and in terms of timeline? This was a guarantee of...
It's a guarantee of all their obligations, so I don't know what that number is.
Was there, to the extent you know, were there any estimates? This was a $10 billion problem, a $50 billion problem?
Oh, no, this is not as bad. Again, this
whatever the
hundreds of billions of dollars problem. It was an over $800 billion organization at the time, so it was a big number. But it's the problem is the uncertainty of it, I think, made it difficult for Barclays as well.
Okay. And the timeline? I mean, this was to get to the point of an approval, as I understand it. So
right.
Was this a two-week problem or a two-month problem? What,
yes.
Was there some sense of time?
Yes, it was. don't know how long that would have. It would have had to be out there. Bear Stearns had a guarantee from JPMC. It must have lasted. Their acquisition was outstanding, what, for a month?
Until June.
March 23rd to...
Until the end of June.
They closed before the end of June.
I think it was the end of June.
Was
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
Ah, so there you go. So 3 months for them.
Okay.
But
so
if you were looking for any... I'm sorry, Tom. But if you're looking for any type of solution that would have worked, including an orderly wind down, don't you got to know how long it's going to take Barclays to get shareholder approval? And if it's not going to take long, you shoot them some cash for a few days, and then the deal gets done.
I mean, life isn't as knowable as that, right? If we could know everything, if we had perfect knowledge at the time, that would have helped. It's the uncertainty about it that is the problem. But I think that we shouldn't focus too much on the length of time, because what Barclays was facing was a determination by the FSA that it needed shareholder approval to give the guarantee. So, you know, I don't think they were worried about the duration. That's not what kept them from giving the guarantee. It was that they didn't think they could get shareholder approval, period. They certainly didn't have time. They couldn't have gotten shareholder approval before they opened on Monday.
Clearly.
Right? So Lehman was at risk with no guarantee and no protection until they could get shareholder approval. If it took them 30 days to get, or 1 week to get shareholder approval, mm-hmm. Lehman wouldn't have made it through the week. As we know,
mm-hmm.
right? Without the guarantee, they went directly into bankruptcy, and they would have had to have gone into bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm. And actually, that raises another question, which is, as I understand it, one perspective on why you all could not be as helpful as you might have been otherwise was the lack of collateral that
right.
Lehman had.
Right.
But I'm curious. That Monday, the Monday they go into bankruptcy, you do extend significant, I mean, billions to them. What was different, either legally or
so we lent to the broker-dealer
okay.
against collateral the broker-dealer had, and we limited our loan to the collateral that they had available.
And was that roughly $60 billion?
I think it was 42. I think it was in the 40s. But we can check.
Right.
It's something in that neighborhood.
Okay.
But that was to the broker dealer, and it met the broker dealer's funding needs. The broker dealer was only about half the size of Lehman. If my memory's right, it was about half the size of Lehman. The rest of the organization, which is what went into bankruptcy, mm-hmm. didn't have the same collateral available to it and needed more.
And was there an assumption that undergirded that extension of liquidity that Barclays would buy the broker-dealer portion of Lehman? Because, of course, they do that almost instantly. But
right.
was there,
they,
I mean, did you know that at the point, or did the Federal Reserve Bank of New York know that at the time it extended 40 or 50 billion?
I don't know if they knew that on Monday or Tuesday. I don't know what when they first became aware that Barclays... I don't know the timing vis-a-vis the lending, which came first.
Okay. But in terms of... Okay, hypothetically, if they didn't know that Barclays was prepared to purchase with the support of the FSA, the broker-dealer, why would those loans have made sense? What would be the rationale for those loans if there wasn't an assumption that Barclays would be able to purchase them, that portion of the company?
So, can you talk about SIPC?
A couple things. One is the rationale behind PDCF was mm-hmm. to facilitate the provide stability to the markets that were supported by the primary dealers. And that's the lending that was being done to Lehman at that time, being done through the PDCF. It also, one of the reasons the PDCF was established to help to support the tri-party repo market because of the concerns about the what disruptions in that market could have for broader market circumstances. So, if we hadn't provided those loans, there would have been serious questions about what would have happened to the tri-party repo market, which not only allowed Lehman to get financing for its book, the broker-dealer, but was also a significant source of financing for the other broker-dealers that were still in existence. And as Scott pointed out, the loans there were more than fully secured by collateral that was regularly pledged to the tri-party repo system. So those were significant reasons. The other part was, part of the concerns about the tri-party repo market was it depends upon clearing banks in order to extend significant amounts of credit intraday. And if the clearing banks are not comfortable that they're going to be able to roll over the tri-party repo funding, so take the collateral that they've been holding themselves for the time period during the day, and roll it back out to the investors, then they're not likely going to allow that funding to go. The collateral will go back to the tri-part investors, many of which don't want those mm-hmm. assets, which could then spark mm-hmm. the fire sale and all that. So the PDCF financing allowed that process to continue while the broker-dealer was looking for its resolution. As the broker-dealer did not file for bankruptcy, it was still solvent at that time.
Yeah, we have a little time out here, so we're at an hour and 15 minutes here, and we're not going to go indefinitely, so I didn't know what other topics do you want to cover, how can we budget our time?
The only topics I think we want to cover is too big to fail, generally, and on institutions and non-institutions, areas where you invoke 13.3 or the fiduciary risk exception. I mean, I don't know where we are in terms of finishing up. I mean, I don't think we're hours away. I would like to think we're done by 5:30 at the latest.
So I've got somebody coming in at 5 o'clock, so I'll
have to
leave it. Well,
then let's bolt for the next 15 minutes at least. Sure. I assume that's okay.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I was just
And we can always follow up later. And maybe
we want to help you out. So
perfect. One of the mysteries that we're trying to unpack is suggestion that one of the problems that Lehman had was its collateral had been locked up based on demands from its clearing banks, JPMC being one of them. Citi is also allegedly implicated. I've read things to the effect that perhaps as much as $25 billion was locked up in terms of they had collateral in their liquidity pool, but it was committed to others. One is that generally correct? Did those orders of magnitude, as far as you know?
I don't know. I don't have to check. It's in the bankruptcy examiner.
Yeah, it's in the examiner.
Okay. There clearly was some collateral that was secured in JPMC because that was a clearing bank. But I don't know about the 25.
Yeah, the trustee cites an SEC email to the effects that there was $25 billion of collateral.
Some of that arose because of sort of record-keeping issues at the broker-dealer about there's uncertainty as to what the collateral was pledged for and mm-hmm. Things of that nature. I think that most of that came up after the sale with Barclays, when the clearing banks were trying to sort through the arrangements.
There were definitely deposits on the order of about $20 billion that I remember there was concern about whether they would be available for the liquidity pool for Lehman Brothers, and did folks know that that was tied up by JPMC or Citi and not available as ready liquidity? And we realized, I think it was in end of July and August, that time frame generally, that the deposits were tied up and so wouldn't be available in liquidity, and told them we thought their liquidity was shy because that couldn't count towards the liquidity pool. I'm not sure how that fits into the question about 13-3 lending. That's certainly also an asset that's not available to be pledged, right? Because
sure.
It's pledged to somebody
right.
else.
But
we weren't, you know, that only becomes an issue on the day they want to borrow.
Right. But I'm just trying to get some illumination of what was, I mean, were these the assets against which you provided $40 or $50 billion, were those the same assets that were subject to these collateral requirements?
No, we would only take unencumbered collateral.
Okay. Because the liquidity pool, as I understand it from your September 12th, 08 daily report, was order of magnitude $33-35 billion.
Like yeah.
So I'm not quite sure.
And
how
that
you
did not include the $20 billion.
That's considered unencumbered.
The liquidity pool is a little. We're talking apples, oranges, and grapes here, right? So the liquidity pool is money available to them to use to pay off debts as they come due. The $20 billion we judged wasn't available for that, so we couldn't count on them having $50 billion. We had to count on them having $30 billion. That's one of the reasons that the urgency of the Lehman weekend, because that $30 billion number was just shrinking quickly. But then when it comes to lending on our by us to them, we only accept unencumbered collateral, so we were never counting on that deposit as collateral for our loans. I don't remember whether that loan was at the broker-dealer or at the holding company, but I don't think in the end that matters.
But I just want to make sure I understand the report right. When we look at that report, you see that $32 billion or whatever it is, and there's cash and boxed inventory. Is that unencumbered collateral that would have been available to secure a 13-3 loan?
I don't know which report
okay.
you're looking at, but the one I know Rich was referring to is the Lehman Bankruptcy Examiner's report. He goes into this deposit in particular. He follows it throughout the summer, and whether or not it was should have been part of the liquidity pool or not part of the liquidity pool. Did the SEC know it was encumbered, for example? Did the SEC include it in its estimation of Lehman's solvency or not? Did we consider it part of their liquidity pool? And he has a whole chapter on that.
So. Since you're our short timer, let me ask you a couple of legal questions.
Yeah.
This is a memo to files, which you were obviously involved with, from the legal division. And firstly, is that something you're generally familiar with?
This sure.
is, okay. And the more important question is that a fair representation of the board's views of the meaning and substance of the various key provisions of 13-3? I mean, it may have changed since this is March of last year, but it's the most current thing I could find that seemed to capture your legal perspectives.
Well, so this memo deals with a particular facility.
True.
So it doesn't try to capture all of our thoughts on 13-3. It just captures what we thought about 13-3 as it applied to the CPFF.
Okay.
So there's memos that we wrote on a variety of different 13-3 transactions, and they're slightly different or focused on different things depending on what the kind of loan was that we were dealing with.
Okay. But would it be fair to say that insofar as this deals with sort of general questions of what, for example, exigent circumstances might be or
yeah.
what security might mean? Okay. And is there something that would be more definitive and complete than this document in terms of what
no.
these key terms might be?
No, we didn't do a single memo that tried to encapsulate. We didn't do a law review article in the depth that Art would have done.
Right.
Someday, perhaps, but right. we were more ad hoc.
Your memoirs, right.
Yeah, right. So yeah. We were more ad hoc. When Bear Stearns, yeah. we did a Bear Stearns memo. When
sure.
CPFF, we did that. TALF, we did a TALF memo. We did an AIG memo. We did one for each yeah. extension.
But would it be the case that when you were, that insofar as these kinds of memoranda and decisions interpret what are admittedly relatively vague terms in 13.3, do you guys regard that as worthy of Chevron deference, or is that?
Absolutely.
Okay, all right, fair enough.
Now, even I will admit that Chevron deference is strongest when there's a rulemaking involved, and this wasn't a rulemaking. But we are an expert agency interpreting our own statute, and we have long history in these interpretations. So I think we would get some deference.
Okay, I agree with that, actually.
Yeah, I think Mead gives you some cover. You don't have to have a notice and comment rulemaking.
Right.
But I do want to explore with you briefly.
But it's still lesser kind
of. Pages 6 and 7, and I can read you what I think is kind of the key, what appears to be the key conclusion here, which is actually the end of the first partial paragraph on 7, which is, and this relates to security acceptable to a reserve bank. And the conclusion appears to be, therefore, the reserve bank has the discretion to accept as collateral securing the Section 13.3 discount of an IPC note collateral of any value, including collateral that at the time of the extension of credit may have a current market value that is less than the amount of credit extended, provided that the credit is secured to the reserve bank's satisfaction. Mm-hmm. So my sort of layperson's take on that is that, for example, if the face value of something is 100 and it's currently valued at 50, a reserve bank, if it's otherwise satisfied, could grant credit up to 100, arguably potentially more, but at least to 100.
Yeah, if I think you could, right, I understand the lay, a lay person would read that and come to that conclusion. It's the ifs that go around that, to be secured to the satisfaction of the Reserve Bank is itself a pretty strong hurdle, and this is in the context of lending where you have, as the rest of the memo explains, you have to be pretty confident you'll be repaid. Mm-hmm. So I think it might be the kind of situation where if we believed that a loan at $100 based on collateral that had a value of $95, where the collateral was appreciating and you had reasonable expectations that the collateral would continue to appreciate, or you were lending with recourse and you expected that the borrower had sufficient financial resources to repay the loan without resorting to the collateral, those situations you might feel secure. But a situation where you're lending without recourse against assets whose value is declining, I think even under this memo, it would be very difficult to justify that under 13.3.
Is there,
and that, by the way, is more the Lehman situation, right? I mean, it's collateral, it's shares where it's only collateral, and the assets that it had, the shares of its subsidiaries and its assets, the only collateral it had, were depreciating at the time.
Is there any additional kind of semi-official or official color or interpretation around this notion of this kind of collateral issue?
I'm not sure I'm interested.
Let me rephrase. Let me give you an example. There's some footnotes in one of the analyses of Maiden Lane, and it suggests there that taxpayers will not have a loss on these Maiden Lane assets because we, the Federal Reserve, will either hold them to full term or we will sell them over time, and our presumption is that at that point we'll get full value on what we loan.
Right.
Is that the kind of thing contemplated here, or one of the kinds of things contemplated here?
Sure, that's certainly part of the equation, part of the thought process on being adequately secured. That's
in those main facilities, we had very strong projections from our financial advisors that the underlying assets would over time pay out sufficient to repay the principal and interest on those loans.
So the other thing is that we never did lend throughout this crisis against assets that had a value that was lower at the time of the loan than the amount of the loan. So this is
including the CPFF.
I mean, this is a hypothetical.
But from your perspective, this is what the law is.
Yeah, I do think the law allows that.
So, which actually makes sense to me. I mean, in one of your other, in fact, I think it may be one of these, that consistent with the statute, the purpose of the statute, being able to do this is wholly appropriate, since it would be a crisis type situation.
Right.
And if there's a fire sale, you presumably could rely on prices going up when the fire sale ended.
Right. I mean, we do have the advantage that we can hold assets at a cheaper funding rate than just about anybody, and if the assets do have an opportunity to appreciate, then we can recover.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, the analysis you were talking about that you did with Bear Stearns and projection of assets in the PNHG, did that same document exist for Lehman? Taking the assets, assessing that their value wouldn't support the collateral?
Nope. No.
Then how did you know you couldn't make a loan under 13?
I think we, folks had a pretty good feeling for the value of Lehman during that weekend. And so there was no memo prepared that documented why it is we didn't lend. It was that it was just the thought that we are not going to lend because the decision makers who were involved in the negotiations, who were on the scene, who were talking to the Bank of America's complaining about the size of the hole and talking to the industry saying we're not going to put up any money to solve this and talking to the Lehman people who are saying, my God, how are we going to open on Monday? They understood from all of that there wasn't enough there for us to lend against, and so they weren't willing to go forward.
But this is actually a general point that I also had to leave five, so that I wanted to make, even in the last meeting that we had on this topic, which is that 13.3 is not the same as too big to fail.
Right.
13.3 is one of the authorities under which we exercise our lender of last resort authority, and that's generally, that's based on the premise that you're avoiding a liquidity failure, but you're not lending to an insolvent institution. So the benefit comes from avoiding that costly, unnecessary liquidity failure, and that logic extends to an institution of any size. And in fact, and so we do that under 13.3, we do that under 10b. And we would and have lent to very, very small institutions in order to avoid a costly liquidity failure. So, I mean, just they're not quite the same thing. There is, of course, overlap, and particularly in the case of 13.3, since there are costs to lending and there's cost to providing this protection, including moral hazard, the benefits must be extraordinary as well. So that's why there's a very high hurdle to exercising that authority. But
was there an understanding of, putting aside the issue of collateral, of how much the loan needed to be?
So we were faced with having to give an open-ended guarantee. It wasn't, Lehman didn't come to us and say, can we borrow $10 billion? It was, will you guarantee our operations tomorrow? How big is that loan?
Not just tomorrow, because there's nobody to take us out.
Yeah, there's nobody to take us out. Right, right. But, you know, you got to get to tomorrow.
Yeah.
Right.
But wasn't AIG an open-ended guarantee?
Nope. AIG was a $85 billion revolving line of credit to an institution that was solvent and had lots of assets. They truly had a liquidity crisis. They had value in their insurance subsidiaries, but no cash to pay their bills.
That's precisely the point that I was trying to make. In the case of the reason why there was no calculation with Lehman, I don't know. I wasn't involved, but perhaps I wasn't involved because the institution did not appear to be solvent.
Right. But I mean, could the Fed have actually gotten the assets of
the insurance companies at AIG?
We have a perfected interest in their shares of their insurance companies. Absolutely. We are well secured and getting repaid. Well, I'd all in all rather not be winning. I would rather not be in this game.
The ones we don't loan to.
Right. So, well, folks, it's five. You guys got to go. So thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And if you want
they will be in touch on if we need to do more.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good to see you again, Scott. Take care. Always a pleasure.
Thanks. Believe me, we understand.
Thank you very much. I just want to ask you a question. Thank you.